This page consists of the whole of Book 7 of Cashin's Institutes, which is on the spirit of avarice, on the temptation towards avarice. And it also includes, at the very bottom of the page, if you drop down there just to see, a little section, section 6, of Conference 1, because this includes a very famous and beautiful vignette on the subject of overcoming avarice with charity. And it includes a rather humorous example of avarice, as we shall see. I've divided this book, that is to say Book 7 of the Institutes, going back to the top of the page again, into three broad subjects. The first is Cashin's insistence that avarice is foreign to our nature. And for chapters 1 to 6, he emphasizes that whereas when one looks at gluttony and lust, one is dealing with something that really exists within our nature, exists literally within our bodies, and has to do with the physical realities of living in the world and necessities of living in the world, avarice does not. We are not naturally attracted to gold or silver, or we might say in our own day, to paper money. And Cashin spends a fair amount of time reflecting on the fact that here we are dealing with a vice that represents something that is entirely learned over time. We learn to associate these things which we hoard with a sense of well-being. The second broad division of this book is chapters 7 to 13, in which he gives a very long vignette or example of a monk afflicted by avarice, and then some examples of others who are similarly led to their downfall by trying to possess things. In the third section of this book, chapters 14 to 31, he distinguishes three species of avarice, three different kinds of avarice, and associates them with three models drawn from the scriptures. The examples of Judas, of Gehazi, which we have already seen in Evagrius, and then the example of Ananias and Sapphira. He, in a sense, is trying to find biblical precedent for three different subgroups within the experience of avarice. So let's now, very briefly, take a look at some sections, some illustrative aspects of these three sections. First, the idea of avarice being foreign to our nature, chapters 1 to 6. He mentions in chapters 1 to 2 his conviction, and it's drawing from 1 Timothy 6:10, that in some sense the real danger of avarice is because it is biblically described as being the root of all evils. There is a way of looking at human fallenness that can see in this a particularly vivid example of how we are separated from God and how we can misuse the gift of our freedom. He talks in chapter 3, in particular, about the distinction between this vice and those which we see in children. Then he goes on in chapter 4 to talk about the fact that it is certainly possible to talk about our faults without thereby laying the blame on God. And again, he finally talks in number 6 about how difficult it is to drive out this evil of avarice. Although it may be foreign to our nature, it is extremely resistant once it's been admitted, once we've learned it. Then, the second broad section, chapters 7 to 13, his series of vignettes, his kind of an illustration of the poor monk who begins down the terrible path of avarice and then utterly falls to pieces. He says in number 7:1, this vice gets hold of the slack and lukewarm soul of a monk. It tempts him in regard to a small sum of money, giving him excellent and what seem like reasonable excuses why he ought to keep something for himself. And then Cashin gives a whole series of natural reflections, but they're of course demonic temptations. What the monastery has isn't sufficient, can hardly be endured. What shall I do if I become ill? How will I support myself in my weakness? The monastery doesn't have enough capacity to do this. I need something if I'm going to take care of my body when I become ill. Notice here the resonance, the reflection of Evagrius' observation that the fundamental problem in avarice is that it causes these fantasies to spring up in the mind, these unrealities about what might or could happen and how we have to protect ourselves against them. That is to say, not to depend on grace. And it continues on in 7.4 down to 7.6, how this madness leads step by step to a kind of idolatry. He says in chapter 8 that avarice is a hindrance to all the virtues, and then he talks in chapter 9 about the fact that having once begun to acquire wealth, the monk will inevitably leave. The original nature of the commitment becomes impossible because he'll no longer be able to see the dispossession that was originally part of his original commitment as something tenable, and he'll even be frustrated and anguished. Even angry with the other brethren for trivial reasons. His avarice will turn into rage, and then finally he gives a terrible or frightening example of it in Numbers 11 and 12. He reminds us again that avarice can be the root of all kinds of evil, and then in chapter 12 he says, I know a monk who, and here he's going to describe the ultimate failing, who contradicts and has contempt for his abbot verbally. He says that at the very end of this chapter, the monk with an angry expression does not hesitate to answer, if you have that with which you can support others, why do you forbid me to have it as well? The monk contradicts and in effect cuts himself off from the possibility of having a life-giving relationship with one who stands in the community in the place of Christ. Avarice has served as the root of a kind of final separation that means that the person will not be able, cannot allow himself to stay in the monastery and will have to leave. So monastery drives one, avarice drives one out of the monastery. Then, the third great section of this book, the distinction between the three different kinds of avarice in chapter 14. Chapter 14:1, he talks about the fact of those who hoard, once they come into a community and have something, even though in the past they never had anything of their own. He's referring to the people who come from great poverty into the monastery and suddenly now learn the possibility of an avarice that they never knew before. Because previously they lived in great want, now they have things, and they naturally tend to hold on to them. Another possibility is the person who afterwards, after having taken on the monastery, then takes up again the things that they have earlier renounced. Those who had something, who then relearn the habit of avarice in the context of religious community. And third represents a faulty and hurtful beginning, a bad start, and people who, as he's described above, through fear of poverty and want, end up keeping back money and property which they ought to have given over. So this is the case of someone who appears to have engaged in self-dispossession as a result of their commitment to community, but in fact has secretly kept something back. And I think probably everyone knows of examples of this that exist in religious life today. Then he associates each of these three subspecies of avarice with three different figures. The first with Gehazi, the one who becomes leprous, the case of someone who had nothing and then acquires the possibility of avarice, this terrible sickness, as Cassian depicts it here, and as Evagrius had depicted it in the Anti-Rheticos, as we've seen. Then the second case, illustrated by Judas, who wants to resume the possession of a wealth which he formerly had. And the number three is Ananias and Sapphira, who keep back part of what they formerly owned. Now, to a very great extent, the rest of the book 7 consists of illustrating these three different kinds of avarice. And I'll leave you to look that over on your own, but I'd like to suggest in a very general way that although in this text Cassian does a very good job of describing avarice, his sense of how you heal it is not as well developed as his conviction that you must learn to identify the different kinds of this particular temptation. He does not emphasize to the degree that Evagrius does, at least in this text, the importance of charity, of love, compassion, eleos, imitating the merciful love of God in regard to the brethren. I remember Evagrius talking about giving gifts as a way of quenching one's own tendency towards resentment. Cassian does not emphasize this as much as one might wish that he could in these coming chapters. But if you drop all the way down to the very bottom, I've given a selection from Conference 1, the first conference of Abba Moses. And in this, Cassian does describe charity as that which is necessary in order to confront avarice. And he gives a very classical, very often remembered and repeated description of avarice. He says in 6.1, and this again is at the very bottom of the page, in the case of some who have despised great possessions in the world, the greatest possessions of the world, have formerly had large sums of gold and silver and properties, now, it's not that they want to resume their old habits, but now they become disturbed and excited over a knife or a pencil or a pin or a pen. Those who had many things can now become avaricious of the tiniest and simplest little things. Whereas he says, if they kept their gaze steadily fixed on a pure heart, this would not have happened. Purity of heart being the goal and aim of monastic life. He mentions in 6.2 that some guard their books so jealously that that becomes a source of avarice. And he is here echoing the apothegm that we saw Evagrius mention about the possibility of giving away all that you have, even the books that are so precious to you. Again, not something that everyone is called to do. And then finally, he talks about in number 3 the fact that ultimately there has to be charity. There must be the gift of giving away in mercy the compassion that one has been gifted with by God, and that it needs to be directed towards others if one is to be freed from this terrible vice. So, although Cassian does not emphasize mercy and compassion to the degree that one might like, it is there within the texts if one looks for it carefully.